in. Today we are going to be hearing from a variety of different people. First of all, people from the Minnesota Environmental Coalition of Labor and Industry. We're going to be hearing some of the things that are being done currently in industry and things that that they're working on to address some of the environmental issues that we're facing today. We do have with us today Joan Archer, who is the co-chair of NECLI and Minnesota Beverage Association. Also, Tom Kaler, who's another co-chair and a member of the IBEW Local 160. If you could state your names for the record, please, and thank you for joining us today.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Joan Archer. I'm the president of the Minnesota Beverage Association. I represent the bottlers and distributors of non-alcoholic beverages, milk, juice, soft drinks, water, those types of items. I'm also here today, as you mentioned, as the co-chair for MECLI, as we call it. Every group has to have its second name. MECLI has been around for a number of years. We're comprised of 70 union, business, and trade associations. And the organization was established in representing thousands of working people in Minnesota. Our mission is to create a forum to discuss environmental issues that are of interest to labor and business, and also to not only promote and protect the environment, but to also promote and protect jobs in Minnesota. We feel strongly as an organization that we can enhance the environment while protecting jobs and growing jobs in Minnesota. And it's my honor to be the co-chair. We've worked on a number of issues this year, just to give you an example of one that business and labor, one of the positions that we had, we supported the Great Lakes Compact, and I know that went through the committee here, and you had some discussion on the House floor, and it passed the floor. So we did support the initiative, all of the labor and business groups. We had a similar discussion as you did in the committee on the various issues. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom, and he can give you a little bit more history on the organization.
I'm Tom Kaler. It's K-O-E-H-L-E-R. I'm the business manager, financial secretary of IBEW Local 160, which we have, my particular local, about 3,000 members statewide. Our biggest employer is Xcel Energy, but we represent a number of the co-ops, REAs, municipals in the state. We have statewide line construction jurisdiction, so the big transmission towers, those kinds of things are done mostly by our members, and we also represent the tree trimmers that are on electric utilities right away. The IBEW represents about 15,000 members throughout the state, number of local unions. MECLI, I've been the labor co-chair now for a number of years. MECLI, I believe, was formally in about 94. We worked informally before that. I won't read all the issues we've worked on, but in the past we've worked on some air quality issues, sales tax exemption on equipment that captured pollutants, mercury emission voluntary reduction program, health risk values for air toxics. Those have been around a while. You may remember the years of the carbon tax, which is coming back in more favor than it was in the years that we worked on it. One issue that labor was wanted for a number of years and the industry did help us with is to get a labor representative on the MPCA board. I don't remember. That's been a number of years ago now. Worked on brownfield development. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Joan Archer and I worked with Senator Hottinger, and one of the schools in his district were looking at recycling programs, and Joan and her members worked with the students to get a recycling program in that school. So those are the kinds of things we've done in the past. That's all I have for now.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler, and we do have a quorum, so I'd like to officially call the meeting to order and also approve the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Tingelstead, would you move the minutes for the last date, February 6th.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move approval of the minutes of the February 6th meeting.
Thank you, Representative Tingelstad. All those, Representative Tingelstad moves the minutes to February 6th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes have been adopted. So, thanks. And if you could please state your name for the record, please. And welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Evans. I'm the Director of Minnesota Government Affairs for Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy is also a member of MECLE, and enjoy working with them on a variety of issues. And we haven't had the pleasure of being in front of this committee this year, at least for the energy issues, though likely we will be here before too long. Let me just make reference to the impact that this committee has on both industry and labor, as well as obviously the environment. From the past, last year, under Chairman Hackbarth's leadership, this committee dealt with mercury reduction in the state of Minnesota, passed, I think, what was considered a groundbreaking bipartisan mercury reduction bill. As a result of that, Xcel Energy, and speaking just for my particular employer, has announced a $900 million reworking of the Sherco coal plant in Sherman County in Minnesota. That will not only increase the efficiency of the plant, getting more energy per pound of coal, but it will also involve significant reductions in a number of pollutants, and particularly mercury, while at the same time employing hundreds of Minnesotans in the multi-year process of reworking that plant. And all of those things, I think, which everyone would consider a win-win-win for the state of Minnesota, were as a result of the work that was done on this committee last year in mercury reduction, and we look forward to continuing that work. This year, we've been dealing with the energy committees on renewable energy, and that's another area where both industry and labor has understands that the state of Minnesota wants to move forward aggressively with renewable energy. Working with the stakeholders, we are moving into this new technology in I think what will be considered a groundbreaking way. Of course, business is always looking to protect the costs to customers in this process. Utilities are always looking for ways to strengthen their business, and labor is looking to make sure that the workers aren't forgotten in the process. So as we work forward on this new technology, renewable energy, all of those interests come together to, I think, put together a good policy for Minnesota. We'll also be dealing this year with conservation changes, changes in the way that utilities deal with conservation, energy conservation, particularly electric energy conservation, and that's going to be another major endeavor this year. And I mention those because what is on the minds of many legislators this year is carbon dioxide and carbon dioxide reduction. And in the utility, the electric utility business, there's really only two ways that we accomplish carbon dioxide reduction, and that's either by having non-emitting resources like wind and by conservation. Those are the two tools that we currently have in our toolbox to accomplish those things. And again, industry and labor and the business community all need to work together to do those in a responsible way that's going to maximize the reduction of carbon and while protecting jobs, protecting ratepayers, and protecting the utility business. So those are the issues that we're going to be working most hard on this year, though there's a number of other issues that always come up with energy, and we look forward to continuing to work with you all on those endeavors.
Thank you, Mr. Evans, and if you could state your name, please, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for inviting me to this committee, this meeting. My name is Stephen Schultz. I'm the Global Energy Manager for 3M. I have a short presentation that I'd like to show you about the energy program we have in our company, and to impress upon you the importance that saving energy is to us. Thank you. Thank you for your patience. As I mentioned, I'm the global energy manager for 3M. I've been employed at 3M for 27 years. Our energy management program has been in place since 1973 and has been continuous. We think saving energy and being energy efficient is a competitive advantage. It fits in with our corporate values. By being energy efficient, we can provide our customers with value. By being energy efficient, we can provide our investors with an attractive investment. By being energy efficient, we can protect our social and physical environment. And when our employees seeing us behave that way, they are proud to be part of the company. Our strategy is to control energy costs, improve operational efficiency, reduce the environmental impact of our operations, and make sure that we've got reliable supplies of energy for our operations. The scope is large. We have over 175 locations worldwide. We track the energy used at all of our manufacturing locations and any other facility that has over 30,000 square feet of space. The smallest facility spent $6,800 on energy last year, the largest over $20 million. We focus most of our attention on the largest facilities. We have 68 that use over $1 million of energy a year. Those are the ones that our energy management department works with most closely. The energy management department at 3M works with our plant operations, obviously, but it also works with our engineering organization. Our technical experts in engineering build buildings and facilities that are energy efficient, and they are also a key contact for our plant operations people and a resource for information. We work with our research and development organization with the idea that if new products and processes are designed to be energy efficient from the very beginning, they will be energy efficient when they arrive at the manufacturing plant and have a long life. We work with our environmental organization on the environmental impact of energy use, and of course our sourcing organization, which procures and contracts for the energy supplies that we have. We think our suppliers have a role to play, as their operations in selling us raw materials have an impact on the cost of raw materials, and we're encouraging our suppliers to be energy efficient. And many of our customers have asked about our program, and we share that information with them gladly to add value to our relationships. Overall, we think being energy efficient makes a competitive advantage for 3M. We use the guidelines established by the EPA Energy Star program. We've been a member of Energy Star for a great many years. I think the Energy Star program gives us a good operational model for the management of our program, and we use that approach. Overall, we've continue to achieve significant increases in energy efficiency. This chart shows the energy and BTUs per net sales of our corporation over the last 6 years, and in the last year we've made about a 10% improvement, exceeding our target. We are interested in increasing our use of renewable energy. Presently, our Austin, Texas facility buys part of its electricity through a utility green power program. We find that advantageous. One of our facilities in Canada has installed a passive solar system to help reduce the use of conventional energy sources. We are working closely with a developer and have a contract in place to use livestock-derived methane for a replacement of natural gas at our Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin facility. And we are continually exploring additional opportunities to use renewable energy, including using opportunities where 3M products might be incorporated. Our program has received national recognition. In 2004, we were recognized by the Energy Star program as Partner of the Year for our leadership in our corporate program. There were about four or five industrial companies recognized as such that year, so we were in an elite group. We were recognized again in 2005 and again in 2006 for our energy management program. And the 2007 awards will be announced in March. We're hopeful that we'll be in that group again, which would set a record for an industrial company earning this award 4 years in a row. I'm very proud of the program that we have at 3M, and I just wanted to share that information with you.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chair, I'm Joan again. Paul is here, and some of our other members are also here. Just to respond to any questions or concerns that you might have. He's not going to testify at this point. We know your committee time is valuable, but we want him to be aware of this organization. It's the major business groups in the state, working with their labor partners, and in addressing very important environmental issues. So we just wanted you to be aware of our organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Archer. And any questions at all for the panelists? Representative Breinhart.
Mr. Chair, not really a question, more a comment. I'm very pleased that you came here to share what you're doing, because I think it's really exciting to see that kind of partnership between, you know, economic concerns and environmental concerns, and the ability to sit down at the table with some long-range vision and look at these issues together. I think that's what we need to be doing as a state. So thank you for setting a good model for us.
Thank you, Representative Breinhart. And I agree. I thank you for coming. And I do have one question. It pertains to, and I'm not sure who could best answer the question, maybe Mr. Evans from Xcel Energy, but I was, I know you mentioned both conservation and new technologies that don't use carbon as ways of addressing the climate change issue. And I certainly see, you know, the incentives that are there for producing new forms of energy. I was wondering, as far as conservation, and this isn't a criticism of the energy industry, this is just something that I think is a part of the market system we have. Obviously, more money and more profits are made by selling more stuff, more energy. I was wondering if you have any suggestions or are working on any way to promote conservation, which doesn't do any economic harm and is beneficial to the company as well as to our environment and to the customers. If you could address that, please.
Sure. excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Currently, the state of Minnesota has what they call the CIP program, CIP, Conservation Incentive Program. And each utility in the state is required to spend a percentage, in Xcel's case it's 2% of its revenues toward conservation efforts. We've spent those in ways that many of you are familiar with, like the saver switch on your air conditioner, where people voluntarily agree that we can turn down your air conditioner when the demand is high to save energy. Fluorescent light bulb programs are another part of that, working with our large industrial customers to find ways for them to save energy through different programs. And program is under a very large review this year. I'm not sure if the bill has been introduced in the House. I think not. There's pieces of it in the sort of omnibus energy bill that the governor introduced, but we're starting to address that over in the Senate. I'm sure we will be addressing it over here in the House as well. Different ways to achieve energy conservation. Xcel estimates that through its efforts, it's been able to save about 0.76% of the expected demand each year, which is actually it sounds like a small amount, but it really is significant over the years as they build up. It essentially prevents us from having to build more power plants as we're able to achieve these conservation goals. We're talking about that, you know, as I say, we're going to be talking about that this year in the conservation legislation that comes forward. One of the concepts that is, you may hear as the jargon gets thrown around, is something called decoupling. And the idea is for utilities, because frankly, when we go out and work for conservation, we are in effect trying to get our customers not to buy our product. And that's kind of backwards from the way most businesses operate. And so the idea is to find ways to decouple the incentives so that the utility companies do have an incentive to go out and find, you know, ever more innovative and imaginative ways to achieve conservation without being financially penalized in the process. And that's going to be part of if you can imagine, it's very complicated. We're a regulated industry, and so there's an enormous amount of regulation that goes into all of our business. And that's something I think you're going to be hearing more and more about in the coming weeks as these bills start moving through.
All right, thank you, Mr. Evans. Are there any examples of the decoupling or how that could be accomplished?
I said it was complicated. That was my way of saying I don't completely understand it yet. So we are... at least one proposal that's been put out is to do a pilot program, decoupling in the gas business versus decoupling in the electric business. Part of the complication is that every utility in the state comes at this differently. Every utility in the state has a different makeup of customers. For example, we're the utility in the Twin City area, so we have most of the residential customers in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota Power, based in northeastern Minnesota, has a very high percentage of large industrial customers as compared to us or compared to some of the others. And then, of course, we have co-ops that are all across the state of various sizes, large and small. So one of the challenges with anything like decoupling is how do we affect all of the utilities fairly and not put together a program that may be perfect for XL but really cripple a co-op, for example. So the decoupling, no, I can't give you an example of how the decoupling is going to work. It's something that a lot of the stakeholders, the interest groups that are concerned about conservation, as well as the utilities and the environmental groups and all are working together on. And I think when that conservation bill starts moving through, we'll have the experts, and it won't be me, who will be able to come in and explain to you how that should work or how that could work.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Are there any other questions at all? Okay, well, thank you very much, and it's great to see you here and talking about the potentials, and I see a lot of synergy developing here around the issue of addressing climate change as well as other environmental issues, and I'm glad to see that industry is also starting to take a major role in these efforts. What we're going to be doing next is hearing from the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, IRE, from the University of Minnesota. And we're going to be talking about some of the initiatives that are being looked at right now, some exciting technologies and innovations that are being put forward and the potential that it offers. We have first with us Mr. Dick Hemmingson, who is the director of IRE. We also have Dr. Jane Davidson, who's a professor at the Department of Mechanical Engineering in the Institute of Technology. So, also with us, I'm not sure your name, but I'll have you introduce yourself. And Director Hemmingson, if you could please state your name for the record. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Dick Hemmingson, the Director of the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment at the University of Minnesota. We're very pleased to be here today. Our intention is to take a fairly rapid and somewhat high-level flyover of some of the research efforts at the University of Minnesota beyond those related to bioenergy and bioproducts. There's been a lot of discussion so far in biofuels and bioproducts, so we're going to touch on some of the other areas of effort and try to do that fairly quickly. And I think, Mr. Chair, if it is all right with you, we might quickly go through these presentations and then sort of function as a panel for questions, because we're going to not go into a lot of depth on any one point, and maybe we can have the dialogue at the end of the presentations, if that's all right.
That would be good.
And I'll introduce the rest of my colleagues as they come up. This is the mission of our Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, and you can read it as quickly as I can, but you can see the major components of focusing on economic development, healthy, sustainable, and diverse ecosystems, and national energy security by developing renewable resources and processes. And this is a mission that has driven us since our beginning back in 2002. Looking at how the funds have been invested that the legislature made available to us in 2003, this is a pie chart that sort of simply describes a significant emphasis on bioenergy bioproducts, significant efforts on wind and solar research that you're going to hear a bit about today, significant efforts in hydrogen research, as well as significant efforts in policy, economics, and ecosystems. One of the areas that we're not going to touch on today that we would certainly appreciate an opportunity to come back is a lot of our efforts on the sequestration of carbon, and we just thought that that was such a big topic we'd leave that one aside for today's discussion. One of the things I think is important for us all to keep in mind is that with all of the discussion on renewable energy and environmental impacts, and particularly it seems on biofuels and bioenergy, I think it's important to keep in mind where we use energy. And this slide shows the distribution of energy consumption. And as you can see, that distribution in non-transportation is significant in both residential, commercial, and industrial applications. And I think it's important to kind of keep this balance in mind as we go forward. So I'm going to touch on just a few very quickly of our hydrogen projects. Dr. Davidson will touch on some additional ones. We are working, for example, some of you have seen Dr. Lanny Schmidt on his work on reforming ethanol and other biomass into hydrogen. And this is sort of going to be the nature, especially the part I present, because I'm not the one doing this work. My colleagues are. But just to give you a sense of some of the different research projects, looking at the possibility of producing hydrogen for fuel cells from ag residues and other waste streams. Some significant projects there, both in terms of using livestock waste and also scaling these systems down. We spent decades scaling these energy production systems up, and one of the efforts in this project is to look at scaling these systems down to where they might, for example, be applicable to a farm scale. Looking at producing hydrogen from swine manure is one of the projects that we're currently working on. And then a couple of three different examples of utilizing microorganisms for microbial research. And you can see why I put the title Hydrogen for Microbe Research when you see the real title of what this work is really about. Actually, this was written up just in the recent issue of one of the magazines that are for scientific journals. And since I can't even pronounce that organism, I'm just going to say hydrogen for microbes. Another source of microorganisms for hydrogen production, a whole other set of microorganisms looking at the prospect of hydrogen production and that means, and also hydrogen production from algae, and also the prospect of algae production for biofuel production, although I said we're not going to talk about biofuels today, so we'll leave that for another day. And the utilization of hydrogen in diesel engines. This, while you can't really see what it is a Volkswagen TDI engine in our Center for Diesel Research. And the manifold that you can see there is an experimental design for injecting hydrogen into the fuel stream with the potential then of perhaps utilizing ethanol in a diesel engine with hydrogen supplements. So some examples of our hydrogen research. With that, I want to introduce my colleague, Greg Cuomo, who is the Director of Operations at Umore Park in Rosemont, and up until recently was the head of the Research and Outreach Center at Morris, to touch on a couple of additional areas. Greg?
Thank you, Dick. And my name is Greg Cuomo. I am the Director of Operations at Umore Park. And I'd like to briefly touch on two projects I've been involved with, one at Morris, which is a wind to anhydrous ammonia project, and the second is some of the work we're beginning at Umore Park. And in Morris, when we began that project, we really started with a basic premise of, say, how as a university and how as an initiative on the renewable energy and the environment do we take the resources that we have in a region and turn them into an economic advantage for the region. Quickly, we turned to renewable energy, and we both have an excellent wind resource in western Minnesota and the ability to grow biomass and biofuel crops. We started with basic understanding that if we're going to really reap the economic, environmental, and energy security benefits that are the promise of renewable energy, we have to develop integrated systems. And with, again, the help of IRE and the legislature, we began that work with a wind turbine, a 1.65 megawatt wind turbine, which is on the West Center for Research and Outreach Center in Morris. What we do with that is we take that energy and we supply it to the University of Minnesota Morris. They can get about 60% of their electricity needs from that one wind turbine. It's a 2,000 student campus. What we don't use there goes out on the grid to Otter Tail Power. When we start to think about those systems, like I talked about, what we really try to think about is how we can store energy, because wind is not dependable, how we can use that energy other times when we need it. And we, again, came to hydrogen as a way to potentially do that, and something that fit well in our region. We developed a three-stage project. We first wanted to be able to produce large amounts of renewable hydrogen. The second thing we wanted to do is look at bridging technologies or how we can use that hydrogen. Because we think about a hydrogen economy, having cars or transportation, we need to be able to produce large amounts of hydrogen fuel to do it. We're not going to really produce large amounts of hydrogen fuel until there's a demand. So what we think about as a university is say, well, how do we use those, how do we integrate bridging technologies? And the third part is to put those things into systems. Phase one, which is actually making renewable hydrogen, was funded by the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources. And essentially what we do is we take wind power and turn it into electricity with the turbine, and we can take a water molecule and split that into hydrogen and oxygen, and we can store that hydrogen. And we can use it then in an engine to supply electricity to the University of Minnesota Morris or other places when the energy demand is high. But we wanted to look further than that, and it came to us that the ability to make anhydrous ammonia was something that fit very well for that region. And anhydrous ammonia, for those of you who don't know, is nitrogen fertilizer used on wheat and corn. Right now, it's made from natural gas. It's imported. It's a $300 million business in Minnesota alone, a $3 billion business for the country. All that money goes not only out of the state, but out of the country. When we hear a lot about the high energy needs of crop production, a lot of that is in inputs, in fertilizer and things like that. So we can start to do that with the resources that we have in the state. And it's totally renewable. They say we do it with wind, as I explained, electricity. Water, we get the hydrogen. We can get the nitrogen right out of the atmosphere. So we're making nitrogen fertilizer from wind, air, and water. So what's really driving this? Again, the demand for nitrogen is high here. In western Minnesota, we have a high wind capacity but low access to the grid. We don't really have a way to use that wind. And by taking it and making anhydrous ammonia there on site, not only helps the economic development in the region, but really helps us to capture that wind resource that we'd otherwise lose. If we think about wind resources beyond Minnesota coming into Minnesota from the Dakotas, there's also a constriction point there in transmission. Can we take that wind and, again, use it in a constructive way so we're not losing that potential? There's a high local demand for nitrogen. One of the real advantages is we have the infrastructure in place. With hydrogen, it's often a challenge of how we develop that infrastructure. Well, every rural community in Minnesota can use, store, move that anhydrous ammonia, so we have that piece worked out. Cost is going up, becoming prohibitive to farmers because of the high raising cost of natural gas, at rural economic development values, and really if we can make this become a reality, and we know it's possible to do, Minnesota can really become a national leader in renewable hydrogen. The question we're addressing within the university is how do we scale that, like Dick was talking about? How do we make it so that we can make anhydrous ammonia with 1, 5, or 10 wind turbines? And that's really the key, and if we can cross that bridge, it has real potential for the state. So where are we with that project now? We're in the design phase with Sebesta Blomberg, looking at how we're going to put this together and looking at a lot of the issues. These systems don't really exist, so it takes a little bit extra time to figure out how we're going to put them together. Trying to identify suppliers. We're working with places like Xcel Energy, the National Renewable Energy Lab, and others to make it become a reality. Collaborating with Norsk Hydro. Right now, the funding that was okay to do this project by the legislature in the last session, there's some questions in the Department of Finance as to whether it's truly a bondable project or not, and we're working that out with them at this time. Very brief synopsis. I just want to quickly touch on what we're doing at Umore Park, which is in Rosemont. It's a thing. I'd be lost without Dick Gerson. What we're really saying, you know, at the university is what we're thinking of developing that land in really a different way. And really saying, well, if we're going to have a city for the 21st century, what would that look like? What would that look like in terms of how we use water and how we use natural resources and how we design communities for people to have access to open spaces? Can we design communities that would encourage people to lead healthier lives with the recognition that 50 to 70% of our health care costs are lifestyle related? So can we as a university both kind of create a model for what a city could look like in the future and at the same time create a research platform for the university where we could be looking into these things and helping drive these things forward? So in terms of energy, which we're talking about today, there's tremendous benefit on the station and in the region for biomass, wind, wastes, biofuels, hydrogen, and other things. And with that, I think we want to be sure that we get other people here, but just to touch on a few of the projects that we have going on.
Thank you, Greg. I'd next ask Dr. Davidson to introduce herself and talk about some kind of a complex of issues, solar, hydrogen, and photovoltaics.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Jane Davidson from the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Minnesota. And what I want to give you a feel for today is the work that's going on at the university in solar energy and also what I think are the opportunities for the state of Minnesota in this area. So first of all, I'd like to just do a little bit of a teaching lesson and divide up solar energy into two broad categories, one which I call large scale, which most of you would call a utility scale use of solar energy, and the other one is distributed. And solar falls into both of these categories. Of the two things that I'm going to talk about today, which are solar thermal and solar electricity or solar photovoltaics, for the state of Minnesota, solar photovoltaics would be the route that we would go, in addition to, of course, our wind and biomass resources. The distributed energy is energy, solar energy that's used at the point of use. This is energy that we would use in our homes and businesses and in industry that we would actually produce on site. It would not be delivered by the utility company. And here I'm going to talk about ongoing work in both solar electricity again and also solar heating and solar hot water. I'd like to talk a little bit about the benefits. Because these are a little bit more difficult to get your hands on than when you start to talk about utility use of solar energy. And I think that one of the first things that I'd like to dispel is that the technologies that we're talking about here are proven and reliable. So many of the issues that revolve around these technologies come to do with cost and implementation. And in fact, for example, for solar hot water systems, there's actually a regulatory body in the United States called the Solar Rating and Certification Corporation, and they not only rate, but they certify commercial systems and actually provide a label very similar to the label you see on your other home appliances that talk about energy. But very important for the solar thermal technologies that we would use for heating and cooling, believe it or not, as well as hot water in our homes, is that the use of solar thermal, at least for most homes, it replaces both electricity and natural gas. But so in many ways, you could consider this a form of conservation. And the natural gas that it displaces can be used for power production. So you're actually saving natural gas for other more immediate uses. It's a very direct benefit to consumers, so people in the state of Minnesota have their own way to contribute to energy security, energy sustainability. And in terms of utilities, throughout the country are looking at these types of technologies in terms of the benefit to peak load management and also for many utilities stabilizes the grid. And if they have infrastructure issues, then it can avoid additional buildings. But the real issues are acceptance and cost. So those are some of the things that you'll see coming forward in our research. So I'd like to dispel the notion that Minnesota is not a good place for solar energy. And so here I'm just showing a map. This is a map that's produced by the National Renewable Energy Lab. And they have similar maps for wind resources, biomass resources. This particular one is for technologies like photovoltaics and solar thermal technologies like solar hot water. So I call those flat plate technologies because they're not concentrating technologies. And if you look at this map, you see that there is indeed a very strong region of solar resource in the southwestern part of the United States. But Minnesota is very similar to other parts of the United States that are making great strides in using solar energy. And in fact, kind of Minnesota all the way down to Tennessee where I grew up, very, very similar all the way over to the East Coast. And I've listed here on this chart that's on the right-hand side of this slide, this is the solar thermal market in the United States. So these are states that, and their market share of solar thermal collectors. And you can see that the expected states, Florida, California, and Arizona, they do have a good solar resource. But if you look at the next down is New York and Illinois, so there's quite a jump there. But Minnesota is very similar to those two states. So here I'm listing the kilowatt hours per meter squared per day. And you can see that Minnesota is about, this is actually Minneapolis, St. Paul, St. Cloud, Rochester have the same numbers. If you go up to International Falls, that number drops down to 4.3. But we certainly have sufficient solar resource to use these technologies. Now what I'd like to talk about is why I think this is so important. And actually, Dick Hemmingson put up earlier a slide that showed the distribution of primary energy consumption in the U.S. that's put out by the Department of Energy. This is it's very interesting because in Minnesota, actually, buildings are 41% of our energy, primary energy consumption. So we lead the United States in a percentage of the buildings. And I've just broken down here into what that energy use is for. And if you, the top broken down circle is for residential houses, and the bottom one is for commercial buildings. And what you see is that we use quite a bit for heat. We have also hot water, and these two are very, in addition to solar electricity, this is a place where we would want to use solar thermal. Now I'd like to talk about the research that's taken place at the university, and I, of course, I won't have time to talk about each of these, but I've tried to choose some of the projects that I think you might be interested in. The first one is one that I lead that is, in addition to being funded by ARRI, it's also funded by the National Renewable Energy Lab, and it's a collaboration with several industry partners. We've been looking at changes, really innovations in materials, so a switch from copper and glass to materials like polymers that are very easy to use in mass production techniques to get the cost down. And I'm very pleased to say that there's a commercial system that is just coming on the market, and the total cost of this system is about $1,200. It's a hot water heating system. The second project that's listed on this slide is a building integrated photovoltaic system. So we've been working with one of the third largest U.S. home builder, Pulte Homes, as well as GE Global Research. This is funded by ARRI and the Department of Energy to look at how to better integrate photovoltaics into buildings for basically to reduce the cost of insulation and also to gain customer acceptance. The next one is a little bit of a jump. This is solar production. I call it solar fuel, solar production of hydrogen. And this is a two-step process, and if I could just simply tell you that I can promise you that even though it looks very complicated, all we're doing is splitting water. The first step has to take place in a region like the Southwest that has a source of concentrated energy, but the hydrogen production can take place any place. And that's the second step, and that's actually the step that we're working on at the University of Minnesota. And this step has just recently started to be worked on all over the world, so people all in many, many countries are looking at this, and we're actually collaborating with scientists at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, or ETH, on this process, and we just put a paper out that I think we have made remarkable progress. There's still quite a ways to go, but this is an exciting, a different way to produce hydrogen. Now what I'd like to do is talk about solar electricity. So I'm not going to go over this slide, but I've listed here, you can see the magnitude of the number of people that are working on photovoltaics at the University of Minnesota. I've picked two projects that I want to talk about because I think they're very, very exciting. The first of these is a silicon nanocrystal inks, and what you see here on the left-hand side are these nanocrystal inks. So they basically come in different colors. And these are applicable to photovoltaics because basically what you do is you multi-layer these inks so that you have a multi-layer of colors, very similar to slide technology for photography. And when you have these multi-layered photovoltaic cells, your theoretical efficiency is 60% rather than 30%, which is the silicon cells that we're most familiar with. And what they're working on at, so this was actually invented at the university, and what they're working on are ways to make this film technology into a commercial product. There is a company that has adopted it, and they hope to get something out in about 2 years. The next project is a big change in photovoltaics. This is the change from a silicon-based photovoltaic system to a non-silicon-based. There is current technology in this area, but the efficiencies are only about 10%. And so what the scientists at the university are trying to do is really a two-step approach to improving efficiency. It's first of all, they're using quantum dots to replace dyes that these are usually called dye-sensitized photovoltaics. They're using the quantum dots to replace the dyes. And you're all familiar what happens to your furniture and your carpet when the sun shines on it, that the color fades. Well, the same thing happens in these solar cells. So these quantum dots improve these cells because they take away that detrimental effect. And then the other thing is that they're using these nano wires, and those are those vertical-looking columns that you see in this picture, which basically allow the electrons to move very quickly and give you a much thicker cell where you can use the solar much more reliably. So I think these are both very exciting projects in photovoltaics. And I would just like to conclude to say that I think that solar energy has a great role to play in the state of Minnesota, and that the University of Minnesota really has a number of groups that are doing excellent research in this regard, and I think that we're going to make a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Davidson. And Director Carmody, is that correct?
Yes. Carmody, is this on?
Yes.
My name is John Carmody, and I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research, which is in the College of Design. Formerly, that was the College of Architecture and Landscape Architecture, so I'm a professor in architecture. I'd like to just talk broadly about energy conservation and sustainable design in buildings. There's a wide range of things going on at the university, and I'll just touch on a few of them. But in general, the building sector, as you saw in some of the early slides that Dick showed, has a very significant impact on global warming. This particular slide is from the 2030 initiative, which has become a very big effort within the architecture profession to cut greenhouse gas emissions from the building sector by half by 2010 and then cut them completely by 2030. And in this slide, it indicates buildings are responsible for 48% of the greenhouse gas emissions. It's different than the slide Dick showed because they're including the embodied energy effects from all the building materials that are manufactured and so forth. But in either case, it's quite a big impact. And here's just some more data on the environmental impact of both commercial and residential buildings in the United States. Beyond the energy and the greenhouse gas emissions that we talk about so much, are this other range of environmental impacts that buildings have as well, which fall under this broader topic of sustainability. 40% of landfills is construction demolition waste. Huge amount of the water resources, and I don't even have it listed here, but obviously stormwater impacts and pretty much any environmental impact has a big connection to buildings, raw material use and so forth. And then finally, the issue of health for the occupants of buildings is also under this umbrella of sustainable design. At the university, of course, there's people that deal with energy conservation from many points of view. You have people working in energy and economic policy at the Humphrey Institute and in applied economics. Within the building technology area, you have the roof panel system Jane mentioned that we're both working on. But there's also wall assembly, new wall panel systems, some being done in the Minneapolis campus in the College of Natural Resources, which has now been renamed something else, I forgot. And then there's also some of that kind of work going on at the Natural Resources Research Institute up at the Duluth campus. There's a building foundation test facility at Rosemont. There's another building envelope test facility up at Cloquet. So there's a range of these kinds of projects to improve buildings. There's also mechanical and electrical projects dealing with energy conversion within buildings. And then finally, there's areas of research that have to do with not so much the invention of a new technology, but how do we assess the environmental impact of things? There's people in both College of Natural Resources and in our group that look at the life cycle assessment of materials. What's the entire kind of cradle-to-grave impact of making certain choices on materials? And all of these things, of course, are going on at the U. I'm going to mention
Representative Wagenius.
Do you mind taking questions?
Nope, go ahead.
As you're making like new wall materials, are you measuring issues of off-gassing?
Mr. Chairman, members, this is that's one of the attributes that people pay attention to is the indoor environmental impacts. And you've seen quite a change in the market in the last 10 years away from these materials that had a lot of off-gassing properties to the low VOC and other kind of healthier materials. That's one aspect of it. When we talk about life cycle assessment of materials, we're also saying how much energy is embodied in it, what's the global warming impact, the water pollution, the air pollution, the solid waste impact of its manufacture and construction and so forth. But health is a big piece of this, yes.
I raise that concern just because, you know, there's so much difference in paints and their volatiles, but also some of the ways we recycle now, we're using ash from coal plants and with the mercury in it to make wallboard, and folks don't know that that's what's going on. And there are certain brands that have it, certain brands that don't have it, so not all recycling is
the best we can do.
That's absolutely true. It's a very emerging field. There's kind of these simple properties like let's do something recycled because that's a good thing, but the professions and the science is moving very rapidly to come up with really reliable, you know, nutrient labels, if you want to think of it that way, for materials. And then you, of course, get into these debates of what should be on those labels, these persistent toxins like things you're talking about or other properties. But there's a huge amount of that work just happening in the last few years.
Can I ask one more?
Representative Guinness.
I don't know enough about this, but some of these technologies, and I worry, if you worry in advance, then you don't have to deal with the problem, but some of the nanotechnologies, what happens when they become waste and how we as a deal with those? Is that part of the life cycle?
Director. Chairman, Representative, I don't know enough about nanotechnologies to really answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe afterwards somebody else here might know a little bit more about it.
Waste management is a huge problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
Legislatively, right?
Thank you, Director. You can continue.
Okay, thank you. So I'm just going to mention a couple of specific projects here that come out of our Center for Sustainable Building Research. Although we're housed in the College of Design, we have a lot of collaborative projects across the university with people in various departments and colleges. One small project, this was an IRI-supported project, is a solar hydrogen fuel cell demonstration project. We have arrays of solar collectors on the roof of the architecture building. Those are used to, as other people have described here, to the energy from that is used to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. And the hydrogen is stored. It could be used in vehicles. It could also be used to run a fuel cell. So in effect, it's taking the solar energy and converting it into a hydrogen for storage so it can be used at a later time. This is a small demonstration project. Excel was very generous in supporting this, I might mention. And these are the old collectors that used to be on the Science Museum before they moved. So it's a recycling project as well. Our center does a lot of work with affordable housing. Initially, we worked with the Wilder Foundation and HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and now we're working with the McKnight Foundation. And these are houses in the Frogtown neighborhood in St. Paul using a new wall panel system, large OSB panels, and they have advantages in terms of energy efficiency, durability, and health. And the critical thing with solving these problems is not that we do, in a sense, what we did in the 70s, solve an energy problem at the expense of health or durability or some other unintended consequence, but we have to do this holistic systems approach to things so that it's affordable, healthy, energy efficient, low environmental impact, and durable at the same time. So that's the intention of that kind of research. I thought I would also mention, in addition to building materials and products and so forth, our center works with the state agencies. We developed the State of Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines. Some of you may be aware of the B3 project, which came into effect in 2004, legislation requiring all state buildings to meet these guidelines, including 30% energy reduction. We developed the guidelines, and we now help the state agencies administer them, and we track the results and do the follow-up on this. And embedded in this work, which I think was a very wise investment now, is essentially you have in place an accounting tool that can look at greenhouse gas emissions, life cycle impacts of all of the different things that go into building design. So this is an example of, I think, a good investment that probably came out of the 2002 legislative session.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Saylor has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. I would just like to go back to your comments about OSB. I was just wondering, in that project you were working on, where was that OSB made and what's different from it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, The OSB in that project is made in these huge sheets that are 24 feet wide, and they come up. They come from factories that are actually made for subflooring, but it creates a real opportunity to make a large panel. I think we've done four houses now. Initially, the only place they were available from was a factory in Tennessee, but we've been working with Potlatch and other companies in Minnesota, and I believe we're in a sense creating a market for them and trying to partner with the forest product companies here.
Please continue.
Okay, so I mentioned the state guidelines. My last slide is just about our work with windows and facade systems in residential and commercial buildings. We have been involved at our center in new technology development, window wall systems with Anderson Windows. A lot of this work is supported by the Department of Energy, and we work with the national laboratories. But we play a role that's a little different than a basic research role as well. We deal with market transformation issues. So we create books, we create websites, we create computer tools, because part of the problem is not that we need to develop a new window technology, we need to figure out how to get people to use it effectively. Many of the technologies we need to cut energy consumption in buildings drastically exist. We just don't either have the right kind of decision-making tools or the right kind of financial incentives to make them happen in the marketplace. So that's another role we play. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Representative Hansen, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize, I had to step out, and maybe this question was asked before, but some of us just took a tour of the Capitol and for a large project proposing renovating the Capitol and changing heating systems and electrical systems, and I'm just wondering if your center had been involved or had been in contact at all with the Capitol Architecture Board, or have you had any interaction with that process or with those folks on this project or in the past?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we wouldn't necessarily interact directly on a project like that. We do work with the State Architect's Office and all of the agencies that do that kind of work, and we're sort of a resource to them. We tend to get more involved in a new building than a renovation because the guidelines that were passed really apply to new buildings. So we're not on the scene on a day-to-day basis on that kind of project, but they know where we are, and we certainly assist with things like that.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Is it coming?
Yes.
I'm sure my next-door neighbor on the fifth floor, Representative Kalin, has got their bill chock-full of ideas that address these, but one issue that some of us have had in the past is just trying to get people to change how they do things, how they design or build or design the landscape. And you talked about incentives to get material out in the marketplace or new ideas in the marketplace. So if you were to try and reduce the energy consumption in our inhabited space to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and so on, what advice would you have for us to try and do that as it relates to state law? We're looking for ideas, so if you have anything, let us know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a big question. I'll just make a couple quick comments about that. I mean, what I'm aware of is that, energy conservation programs do work. Somebody has to make the investments, to make them happen, but there are a lot of examples of them. And Excel does a lot of good programs, but I think you can really up it to another level. But when you're talking about new building design, I mean, it's possible today to cut, energy use on a new building 50-60% from what our normal building is without too much trouble. And one of the state architects reminded me yesterday, because I said I was going to be here, to make the point that there's a disconnect between the funding for a building and the life cycle operating expenses of the building. They get a flat amount of money to do that building, and if they say, well, if we spent 5% more, we could save a huge amount of money over the life of the building, that 5% doesn't exist. It's over in another pocket somewhere, and there needs to be mechanisms like the revolving funds or something to make that kind of thing possible. So, you know, there's technological barriers, there's institutional barriers, and then I'm expecting, I don't know too much about this, but I've heard about this climate strategies group that the governor has proposed in his bill. I'm expecting that that'll be a good process to really identify a lot of those things.
Representative Lagunias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fascinated by the new technologies for new buildings, but I have a district that there's probably not been a new house, maybe one or two built in the last 10 or 15 years. It's just old housing stock, and lots of us have that. What would it take for you all to be helpful to these old houses that were built in the 1900s, all the way up to the 1970s? Well, what would it help? What would be helpful for us to think about there? To tell you about, or?
Well,
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, there's a lot of knowledge about how to deal with that. I live in a 1907 house in South Minneapolis myself, so I know about it. But you can significantly improve a house if you want to replace the mechanical systems and replace the windows and tighten up the house and put in insulation and so forth. It's usually a financial barrier more than anything else. And there have been weatherization programs. There has been a lot done over the years. But if we treat this like a crisis and we want to do every house and do it, to a higher level, I think the tools are there. It's just figuring out how to make the economics work. I mean, I sit in conversations with people that are trying to figure out what's the next renewable fuel source, and that kind of basic research is really critical. But it's much cheaper. You could buy everybody in Minnesota new windows and probably be good for our window company economy here as well. Cheaper than you can go out and develop new fuel sources. And so there's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot of knowledge and expertise beyond what I know to do those kind of programs if you really want to take them seriously.
Representative Reinhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Carmody?
Mr. Carmody.
Mr. Carmody. Okay, I didn't want to understate your credentials. So.
Yeah, architects usually
Well, you talked about market transformation. And what I'm interested in is whether you directly impact the construction trades and training and, what's your direct connection to what's going on out there in home building right now, and what could we do to facilitate that?
Mr. Carmody.
Mr. Chairman and members, we are, when I say we, I mean collectively, there's a whole group of people at the university that do various aspects of this. My particular office probably does less builder training than people over in natural resources and biosystems department does. I think that's a big question. There's kind of a whole ecosystem of people that deliver all of these elements of market transformation. Our place in the ecosystem is more about design professionals, tools and information, linking people, because we can create specific things that really help people make correct decisions, and that's kind of our skill area. There's other people in this overall ecosystem that can do training at many levels, but we're involved in the Twin Cities Builders Association is doing a green building program right now, and we're advising them and helping them write those guidelines. That's on the private sector side. In the public sector, if you think of affordable housing, we're working closely with Minnesota Housing or MHFA to improve their guidelines for green buildings significantly, and then training becomes part of that package. We aren't always the ones that do that, but there's a lot of activity going on now that hasn't, you know, it's bubbling up all over, and it wasn't there 5 years ago.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, I think we'll conclude. I certainly want to thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for this opportunity. I would just mention a couple of things. One, I believe you've all seen our annual report, but if by chance you haven't or want another one, there are some back here. The staff can distribute them. It's a bit of a challenge to describe our efforts and the fact that we have now funded about 120 different research projects under this initiative. So we tried to give you a brief sampling of some of the efforts beyond biofuels and bioproducts here today, and we would certainly look forward to the opportunity, either formally or informally, to continue this dialogue.
Thank you, Director Hemmingson. And I was glad to hear a lot of the questions pertaining to conservation, and I think Director Carmody, you referred to the fact that you can probably get the biggest bang for the buck in putting money into conservation. And that's one of the reasons I had asked the questions earlier about conservation practices and how to create incentives for that. However, I was just wondering, as far as the new alternative sources of energy are concerned, you know, we're going to be talking about the biofuels next week. But when you're looking at these different alternatives, which one would have the greatest potential in your view, or is the closest to having some kind of breakthrough and providing cleaner renewable energy for us? If you could address that. I know that's a difficult thing. We want to be obviously working on all these renewable sources of energy, but where do you think our resources could best be expended?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm not an expert on every one of the possibilities, but I do want to make a comment about the solar technologies that are designed for buildings, where we've had a lot of discussion. Those technologies are ready to go. So it's really, as one of my friends said yesterday, it's a slam dunk. And particularly solar hot water. This has a relatively short payback period, and is economically viable. And so it's any type of, there are some federal incentives now. And I would say that many states are taking a very proactive view towards providing incentives, builder trade acceptance, approval at various regulatory levels. And so I think that that's a real opportunity. Certainly when you look at corn ethanol in the state, that's obviously a going concern. Photovoltaics are another one that I think that's a very, very fast-growing business in the U.S. and abroad, and I think that there are some real opportunities for, I won't say quantum leaps, but substantial leaps in both efficiency and reducing costs. So, but you know, many of these technologies are a ways out, but many of the solar ones, the solar thermal and the solar electricity, are here today.
Thank you, Dr. Davidson. And Representative Saylor, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Davidson, could you speak at all to what some other countries are doing with regard to requirements with new home construction, requirements and or incentives, and solar hot water heating systems?
Dr. Davidson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can give you a little bit of insight, and I could certainly provide you with more substantial information. But I think that one of the most interesting comparisons that people make is between the United States and Germany and Austria. And so I picked Germany and Austria because these are countries that actually have a lower resource than the state of Minnesota. But the country of Austria, for example, has more solar thermal collectors than the entire United States. So European countries are offering very good financial incentives for individuals to purchase these systems. And that's occurring all over the world. The largest use of solar is in China. And there the systems are very inexpensive. Those systems are coming to the United States. Initially when the Chinese products came to the United States, there was some concern about quality, but I believe many of those concerns have been alleviated. And so we are behind as a country with both the developing and the developed world.
Thank you, Dr. Davidson. Any other questions? Representative Dill.
Dr. Davidson, do you know any, what does it cost to put in a hot water system for a residence that's powered on solar? At my cabin in Canada, we used to have a 10,000-watt generator, and we were always fixing on it, and we were always hauling diesel fuel in the plane to run it, and it's always noisy. And so I bought a $10,000 solar system for my cabin, and that included water. And now it's a water pump that pumps it out of the lake, and we use propane for a hot water heater. But I have been absolutely shocked at how much. I mean, that is the simplest system in the world. A little tiny converter. We can run hair dryers. It's nothing compared to a house. But I mean, it's just amazing. And with these new light bulbs, never run out of electricity. And so I was just wondering, how much does it cost to really do hot water in a house with solar? Do you have any ideas compared?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I have some ideas, but the marketplace, it really sets the price. I can tell you that if you ask the Industries Association what a solar hot water heating system should cost, that would consist of two collectors, so this system would normally provide about 50 to 60% of your hot water needs. Most solar systems always use a backup, so you would use your normal gas or electric system. If you try to provide 100% of the hot water, they can become quite expensive because of storage needs. But the cost of quotes are usually on the order of $2,500 for a system like that. In regions of the country where there's not a large market in place, and you don't have a large number of installers, then the price can go up substantially. And, of course, it's less expensive when you put them on a new home than a retrofit, but they should fall in that $25,000 to $3,000 range, ideally, across the country.
One thing I can tell you that I was shocked at, and this is, when we first put in this solar system, and this is nice, it really was nice, it revolutionized the cabin in the woods, way up in the woods, as a matter of fact. We had 12-volt fluorescent lights. That's what it ran off of because it's two 12-volt batteries at the system. Then we bought this inverter, and we put in these new lights that look like the tail of a pig. You know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Okay. Well, we always ran out after two cloudy days, the lights would get dim if you had all the lights running in the house, you know, all night, every night. But with those pigtail lights and that inverter, we never run out of electricity. I'm amazed at how much less electricity they're using than those 12-volt fluorescent lights. So anyway, I put them throughout my whole house. I'm the most energy-efficient guy you know now.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Any other questions at all? Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us today. Very good. We will next week, February 13th, next Tuesday, we're going to be having a joint hearing with the House Energy and Finance and Policy Committee, and we're going to be hearing information on biofuels and terrestrial carbon sequestration. And we're going to have Dr. David Tillman here from the University of Minnesota, also Dr. Ed Nader, and Cheryl Miller, who's the project coordinator for the Terrestrial Carbon Sequestration Initiative. Meeting is adjourned.